Hi, we have some exciting news. Crime House Plus and Murder True Crime Stories are celebrating America's 250th by dropping a four-part limited series on the crimes that built America. These are the crimes and cases that gave us Miranda rights, sparked criminal profiling, and a murder that built America's missing children movement. Follow Murder True Crime Stories for a new episode every Monday leading up to July 4th, or you can listen to all of them right now with Crime House Plus. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of the show's page.
This is Crime House.
When 34-year-old Shanann Watts didn't show up for her doctor's appointment on the morning of August 13th, 2018, her friend immediately knew that something was wrong. Shanann never missed a call. She never went off the grid, and she was supposed to hear her baby boy's heartbeat for the first time that day. Her husband, Chris, said he didn't know what happened. He said Shanann must have gone to a friend's house with the kids, but nobody was buying it, especially not the people who knew her best. Today, I'll take you through the day Shanann Watts disappeared, the investigation that followed, and how the walls started closing in on the man everyone had trusted to take care of her. Every crime tells a story about the people involved, the system that tried to stop it, and the nation that couldn't look away. Some cases are so shocking, so deeply woven into who we are that decades later, we're still asking, how did this happen? I'm Katie Ring, and this is America's Most Infamous Crimes. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'll take you deep into cases that have a lasting imprint on society and still haunt us today. I want to thank you for being part of the Crime House community. Please rate, review, and follow America's Most Infamous Crimes wherever you get your podcasts. And to get all episodes at once ad-free, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. Before I get started, please be advised that this episode contains descriptions of domestic violence, murder, and violence against children. So please listen with care. This is the second episode of our three-part series on the Watts family murders. Today, I'll take you through the morning Shanann vanished, the frantic search that followed, and how investigators began to see through the mask Chris Watts had been wearing for months. On the morning of August 13th, 2018, Nicole Atkinson woke up expecting a text from her best friend. It should have been a good day. Shanann had a prenatal appointment at 10 a.m. She was 15 weeks pregnant with her third child, and she was supposed to hear his heartbeat for the very first time. It was a milestone Shanann was counting down to, and something she wanted to share with everyone in her life the second it happened. But 10 o'clock came and went, and Nicole's phone stayed silent. She tried calling and texting, but there was no answer. That alone was weird. Shanann was practically welded to her phone because of her Lavelle business. She responded to messages almost instantly at all hours of the day. Going dark for even a couple of hours was completely out of character. But going dark on the morning of her baby's first heartbeat appointment, that was a major red flag. Nicole decided to drive over to the Watts house to check on Shanann in person. Maybe there was a perfectly simple explanation, like she was just sick or dealing with one of her lupus flare-ups and couldn't get to the phone. But when Nicole pulled up at the quiet suburban street in Frederick, Colorado, she didn't see any signs of life. The house was empty and quiet. She walked up to the front door and knocked, but nobody answered. Then she called out Shanann's name, but still nothing. That creeping gut feeling, the one every true friend recognizes when you just know something isn't right, settled in and refused to leave. Nicole called Chris at work and told him he needed to come home now. He said he was on his way. She also called the Frederick Police Department just to be safe. At 1:40 p.m., Officer Scott Coonrod arrived at the Watts' house and Nicole filled him in. Shanann was 15 weeks pregnant. She had lupus, she never went anywhere without her phone, and she had missed her prenatal appointment that morning without a word to anyone. Something was wrong. Officer Coonrod checked the house from the outside and called through the front door, but he couldn't enter without more cause or permission from one of the homeowners. Nicole told him that she had called Chris and that he was supposedly on his way, but every time she called him for an updated arrival time, Chris pushed it back. He said he was coming. He said he was almost there, and then he'd delay it. Until finally, Chris's car pulled into the driveway and gave Officer Coonrod permission to search the home. When the three of them went inside, the house was empty. Shanann, Bella, and Cece were all gone. There was no sign that anyone had left in a hurry or had been taken against their will. But there were signs that something wasn't quite right. Shanann's car was sitting in the garage. The car seats were still buckled in. Inside of her house, her wedding ring was on the nightstand. Her phone was on the upstairs couch. Her purse was on the counter, and her lupus meds, the pills she needed every single day, were still inside of it. Officer Coonrod asked Chris if they could look through Shanann's phone. Chris said yes and gave them the passcode. It was the due date of their unborn son. After unlocking the phone, Coonrod scrolled through it. No calls or texts had gone out that morning. The last activity was from the night before, when Shanann had gotten home from her trip. There weren't any messages suggesting she was upset or any indication that she had contacted someone to pick her up or come get her. Whatever had happened to Shanann, it hadn't involved her reaching out for help. At that point, Officer Coonrod made a call. He wanted a detective at the house because the situation no longer felt like a routine welfare check. When the detective got there, the two of them conducted a more thorough search. No broken windows, no overturned furniture, no obvious signs of a struggle anywhere. There was no blood, scuff marks, or any indication of violence. The house looked like a normal suburban home in every way, except that the people who lived in it had vanished. But in the master bedroom, there was something investigators noticed. The comforter, the fitted sheet, and the pillows were all on the floor. It looked like the bed had been hastily stripped. And the top sheet, the one that should have been right there with everything else, was missing entirely. They searched the laundry room, the closets, and the garage, but it was nowhere in the house. A missing sheet might seem like a small thing, but to experienced investigators, it was a detail that stood out. Because sheets are one of the most common items used to wrap and transport a body. Nicole confirmed what the officers were already thinking. Shanann would never leave the house without her phone. She would never leave without her meds, and she would never, under any circumstances, just disappear with two small children and not tell a single person where she was going. It wasn't possible, not the Shanann she knew, not the woman who documented every meal, every milestone, every moment of her kids' lives on social media. That woman did not just vanish without a trace. Foul play was definitely on the table, but without more evidence in the house, the only thing left to do was check whether the neighbors had seen or heard anything. Thankfully, the man who lived next door had a home video surveillance system, and when Officer Coonrod asked to see it, the footage told a story Chris hadn't. At 1:48 a.m., the cameras recorded Nicole Atkinson's car pulling away from the Watts house after dropping Shanann off. That part already tracked because Nicole had told them about the late-night airport pickup. As they continued going through the footage, something happened that gave me the chills. The neighbor was showing them the security footage on his TV, and randomly it flipped to a bizarre video or ad that showed a fetus in the top of an hourglass, and in the bottom of the hourglass is a bomb that goes off. When it shows a skull with what looks like black oil surrounding it. Then it flips back to the security footage. The video prompts Chris to mention that Shanann is actually 14 or 15 weeks pregnant, and that's why her friend mentioned low blood sugar. Immediately after that happened, he clearly starts to get even more uncomfortable. He turns away from the officer and starts to fidget and sway and look down at his phone. The clip went viral, especially because of the oil element, which made people think Shanann was sending some kind of message. As they kept watching the surveillance video together, the cameras captured something else around 5:17 a.m. Chris's work truck was slowly backing up the driveway and into the garage, enough that the back of his truck was tucked inside the garage and obscured from the street. Shortly after, the truck pulled out and drove away. No other vehicles were seen at the house after that. Both the neighbor and Nicole told the officer the same thing. They had never seen Chris back his truck in like that before. But Chris had an explanation ready. He said his tools had been stolen recently, so he now loaded and unloaded them from the garage to be safe, and that's why he backed in. He also gave more detail about the morning. He said Shanann had been in bed when he left for work. She told him she was going to take the kids to a friend's house later that day. He didn't ask which friend or when she would be back, he just left. Now think about that for a second. Your wife comes home at 2 a.m. from a business trip. She's 15 weeks pregnant. She's exhausted, and you're telling investigators that she casually mentioned she'd be taking the kids to a friend's house later. And you didn't ask a single follow-up question. Not which friend, not when, not whether she needed help getting the girls ready. You just walk out the door. Yeah, I'd say that's pretty suspicious. And Chris also admitted that after Shanann got home from her trip the night before, they talked about separating. He said the conversation was emotional, but not a fight. He said they'd been discussing the possibility for weeks and framed the whole thing as a mutual adult conversation between two people who were simply growing apart. But the way he described it was almost too composed, like he'd already practiced exactly how much to reveal and how much to hold back. Nicole listened to all of this, and she didn't buy a word of it. Something about Chris's attitude felt deeply wrong, like he was defending himself before anyone had ever accused him of anything. He wasn't acting like a worried husband. He was acting like a man trying to control a narrative. There was no urgency in his voice, no fear in his eyes, and he wasn't pacing the room, calling Shanann's friends, or driving around the neighborhood looking for her. He was just standing there, answering questions, calm as can be. And that calm was the thing that unsettled Nicole the most.
Hi, listeners. It's Carter Roy, host of Murder True Crime Stories. I wanted to let you know that Crime House Plus and Murder True Crime Stories are celebrating America's 250th by dropping a four-part limited series on the crimes that built America. These are the crimes and cases that gave us Miranda rights, sparked criminal profiling, and a murder that built America's missing children movement. Follow Murder True Crime Stories for a new episode every Monday leading up to July 4th, or you can binge all of them right now ad-free with Crime House Plus. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of this show's page.
Around 3:40 p.m. on August 13th, 2018, after the police had come and gone from his home, 33-year-old Chris Watts picked up his phone and texted his girlfriend, Nicole Kessinger. He told her his family was missing, he had no idea where they were, and that Shanann had taken the girls to a playdate and hadn't come back. Despite delivering that kind of news, Chris seemed calm, almost detached. Nicole was concerned, but she didn't want to overreact. Chris said it was probably just a misunderstanding. Maybe Shanann was upset and had taken the kids somewhere to cool off. These things happen, right? But then Nicole turned on her TV. Local news cameras were already parked outside of the Watts home. Reporters were broadcasting live. Neighbors were being interviewed. The Frederick Police Department was treating this as a serious missing persons case, not some domestic disagreement that would blow over by the morning. And as Nicole watched, the details she was hearing didn't match anything Chris had told her. The news anchors described Chris's family. His two young daughters, 4-year-old Bella and 3-year-old Cece, and his wife, Shanann, who he was very much still married to, who was also 15 weeks pregnant with their third child. Nicole sat there trying to process what she was hearing. Chris had told her the divorce was finalized. He'd told her he was living in the basement. He'd asked for her help to find him an apartment. He'd written her love letters and planned a future with her. And none of it had been true. The man she thought she was building a life with was a liar. And now his pregnant wife and two little girls were missing. Nicole didn't want to think what she was thinking, but she couldn't stop. If Chris could lie to her that easily about being married, what else was he capable of? All through that night and in the morning of August 14th, Nicole confronted Chris over the phone. She hammered him with questions about his marriage, about Shanann, about the pregnancy. Chris admitted that yes, he'd lied about the divorce. He said he was sorry. He said he and Shanann had been separated emotionally, even if the paperwork wasn't done yet. He was trying to spin the narrative again, the way he'd been doing since the moment they met. But Nicole was done listening to him. She told Chris she didn't want to speak to him again until his family was found. Then she hung up. And then she did something Chris hadn't anticipated. She called the police. Meanwhile, on August 14th, investigators were growing increasingly worried. More than 24 hours had passed since anyone had heard from Shanann, Bella, or Cece. The likelihood that they were safe was dwindling by the hour. That morning, the Colorado Bureau of Investigation made it official. They released endangered missing persons alerts for all three of them. Shanann's face, along with photos of her two daughters, appeared on news broadcasts across the state. After that, the community rallied. Strangers shared the alerts on social media. Vigils were organized. Search parties were discussed. People who'd never met the Watts family felt the weight of what was happening. And while all of that was unfolding publicly, investigators returned to the Watts home for a second search, this time with reinforcements. They brought canine units, specifically cadaver dogs, animals trained to detect the faintest traces of human decomposition. When a person dies, their body immediately begins releasing a unique chemical signature. Even if a body has been moved, the scent lingers in the space where the death occurred. The dogs can pick up on traces that are invisible to the human eye and undetectable by any machine. What the investigators wanted to know was simple. Had Shanann and the girls been killed inside this house, or were they alive when they left? The dogs went through the home, and while the full results of that search weren't publicly disclosed at the time, the fact that cadaver dogs were deployed at all told the community everything they needed to know. Investigators weren't just looking for a missing family anymore. They were looking for evidence of a crime. While the canine unit searched inside, Chris Watts stepped out onto his front porch and gave an interview to Denver 7, the local ABC affiliate. Standing there in a t-shirt with his arms folded, he addressed the cameras and spoke directly to the public. He said he and Shanann had an emotional conversation the night before she disappeared. He didn't go into specifics, but he said it wasn't a fight. He said he wanted nothing more than his wife and daughters to come home safely. He looked into the camera and said, "Shanann, if you're out there, just come back." He also said something about wanting everybody to just come home. And when the reporter asked what he missed most, Chris paused. Not the kind of pause that comes from being overwhelmed by emotion, but the kind that comes from a man trying to figure out what the right answer is. Then he said he missed seeing the girls running around the house and hearing them laugh. On the surface, it was a husband making a public plea, the kind of thing you see in missing persons cases all the time. Families go in front of cameras, they beg for help, they fall apart on the screen. It's gut-wrenching to watch, but it's real. Chris's interview didn't feel real, though, and people noticed. To viewers who were paying close attention, something about Chris felt deeply off. His body language was stiff. His voice was flat. He rocked slightly on his feet, almost like a person giving a book report, not a man whose world had just been destroyed. There was a strange detachment to the way he spoke, like he was reciting lines he'd practice in front of a mirror rather than speaking from the heart. He didn't cry, he didn't break down, he didn't look like a man in agony. He looked like a man putting on a show. And the internet picked up on it almost immediately. Comments flooded social media from people who said something about Chris didn't sit right. Amateur body language analysts dissected every second of the clip. The word guilty started appearing in comment sections before the police had publicly named a single suspect. It was the kind of performance that fooled some people, but it didn't fool the ones who mattered. Hundreds of miles away in North Carolina, Shanann's mother, Sandra Rusek, was watching every second of the news coverage. She studied Chris's face on screen. She listened to his words, and the longer she watched, the colder she felt. She knew her son-in-law. She'd watched him interact with Shanann and the girls for years, and something about the way Chris was conducting himself, the tone of his voice, the casual way he talked about his missing family, and the lack of urgency didn't match a man who was genuinely afraid for his wife and children. Her suspicion only grew when she managed to get Chris on the phone. He told her he couldn't talk long because he had to go back to work. His pregnant wife, his two daughters, and his unborn child were all missing, and Chris was worried about clocking in. The only explanation that made sense to Sandra was a terrifying one. Chris knew what had happened to them. And maybe he needed to get back to work because the oil site was where he had hidden the evidence. Sandra called the police and she told them what she was thinking. She explained that there had been serious marital problems between Chris and Shanann all summer. She told them about the emotional distance, the arguments, and the way Chris had been pulling away for months. She told them plainly that she believed her son-in-law was responsible for their disappearances. Investigators listened carefully. They already had their doubts about Chris. His story had inconsistencies, his behavior was off. The surveillance footage of his truck backing into the garage at 5:17 a.m. was suspicious. And now the victim's own mother was calling in to say she thought it was him. It was time to dig deeper. So they pulled Chris's phone records. The results were a gut punch. Chris's phone showed an endless stream of late-night calls, text messages, and semi-nude photographs exchanged between him and his coworker, Nicole Kessinger. This obviously wasn't a casual workplace friendship. It was a full-blown affair, one that had been going on for weeks while his pregnant wife was out of state. Just like that, Chris Watts became the prime suspect. And investigators didn't even have to go looking for Nicole, because before they could pick up the phone to call her, she beat them to it. Nicole had already contacted law enforcement on her own initiative, within hours of seeing the news coverage. She wanted to tell them everything she knew, and everything Chris had told her. She sat down with Colorado Bureau of Investigation officials and FBI agents. They wanted to understand the full scope of her relationship with Chris, if there was any chance that Nicole and Chris had planned this together. But Nicole's story was consistent from start to finish. She told them that she'd met Chris at work in June. He said he was separated and divorcing, and she believed him. They started seeing each other 4 to 5 times a week. She told them about the love letters, the apartment hunting, and the Great Sand Dunes trip, but said she hadn't met anyone in his life. No friends, no family, definitely not his daughters. And she told them about how it all came crashing down the moment she turned on her television and saw the truth, that Chris was still married, that his wife was pregnant, and that his entire family had vanished. Nicole was emotional, cooperative, and clearly shaken. After hours of questioning, investigators cleared her of any involvement. But her testimony gave them something invaluable, a motive. Chris Watts wasn't just a man in a troubled marriage. He wasn't just a guy who'd drifted apart from his wife and was thinking about divorce. He was a man who'd built an entirely separate life with another woman, a life that was completely incompatible with the one he already had. He was in love with Nicole. He was planning a future with her. And to make that future real, he needed his current family to disappear. Not in a metaphorical sense, not through lawyers and custody agreements and awkward co-parenting schedules. A divorce would have been messy and public. It would have exposed the affair, destroyed the image Chris had carefully maintained, and likely cost him financially, especially given the family's already precarious money situation. And it would have meant shared custody of the girls, which meant he'd never fully be free. He'd always be tethered to the life he wanted to leave behind. Chris had apparently decided those routes were too complicated. He wanted a clean break. And in whatever dark corner of his brain where he'd been making these calculations, the only way to get one was to erase the life he already had. What makes this case genuinely chilling is that Chris apparently looked at his options and decided that murder was the simplest solution to a problem that millions of people solve through paperwork. Investigators didn't have a confession yet, they didn't have the bodies, but they did have the surveillance footage of his truck at 5:17 in the morning, a missing bedsheet, a wife who left behind her phone, her purse, her medication, and her wedding ring, and a husband who didn't cry, who wanted to get back to work, and who'd been having a secret affair for months while lying to everyone in his life. And most of all, they had the motive to tie it all together. The pieces were falling into place, and Chris Watts was running out of time. At the end of each episode, I like to take a moment to answer any questions you may have about the case and share my thoughts. So make sure to comment below.
Chris did that TV interview where he stood on his porch and asked Shanann to come home. What was your read on that?
I do believe that people grieve differently, but when I saw Chris's interview for the first time, it was clearly something different entirely. The most sinister part that stuck out to me was the clear moments of Duper's delight. If you're not familiar with Duper's delight, it's the brief, involuntary flash of pleasure or satisfaction, usually in the form of a smile or smirk, that a person displays when they believe they're successfully deceiving someone. Seeing his little smiles and smirks during that interview makes my skin crawl. Besides that, Chris's interview is basically a case study on what a guilty person looks like when they're trying to perform innocence. He said all the right words, I want them back, just come home, but the delivery was completely hollow. There was no desperation, no raw emotion, no sense that this man's world had just been torn apart. He looked like someone going through the motions of what he thought a worried husband was supposed to do, without any understanding what it actually feels like. He also referred to them a few times in the past tense, and his body language changed every time he thought the cameras weren't on him. Compare that to press conferences you see in cases where the family is genuinely in the dark. If they aren't already clearly emotional and crying, they are usually in a state of shock and come off as flattened, muted, or exhausted. But Chris came across as oddly energized at points during his interview. He was trying to fake the role of a grieving father and husband, but he was just a terrible actor.
Shanann's friend Nicole Atkinson basically cracked this case open by raising the alarm so quickly. Do you think the outcome would have been different if she hadn't acted the way she did?
I genuinely think Nicole Atkinson is one of the unsung heroes of this case because she didn't wait, she didn't second guess herself, she didn't talk herself into thinking everything was probably fine. She knew Shanann. She knew Shanann missing a prenatal appointment without a word was a 5-alarm fire, and she acted on that gut feeling immediately. She went to the house, called Chris, and called the police within hours. And the most impressive part was how convincing she was. In almost every other case, if someone said their friend hadn't texted or called them back in just a few hours, the police would usually wait at least a day or two before they really took the case seriously, but they believed her right away when she said she knew something was wrong. If Nicole had waited even another day, if she told herself Shanann was probably just busy or had gotten into an argument with Chris and was trying to cool off, Chris would have had more time to clean up, more time to get his story straight, more time to create distance between himself and the evidence. The fact that the police were at the house that same day is a direct result of Nicole Atkinson refusing to let it go. She trusted her instincts and she was right. And I think that's a lesson for all of us. If something feels wrong, act on it. Don't wait for permission to be concerned. But with Nicole, most of all, she was just a really great friend.
Shanann's mom, Sandra Rusek, watched that news interview and immediately knew something was wrong. Mothers seem to have an instinct for this kind of thing. Do you see that pattern in other cases?
I always say that as a woman, your intuition is your biggest asset, and I think this applies even more to moms, and it is so important to listen to that and to listen to your gut. I can think of so many cases where a mother or a close family member watched a press conference or a public plea and just knew. It's not always something they can articulate in the moment. It's more of a feeling because they know that person. They know what real distress looks like on that face. And when what they're seeing doesn't match, that alarm goes off. And in this case, Sandra definitely listened to her gut, and she didn't just sit with that feeling. She called the police and told them directly, I think my son-in-law did this. That takes courage because at that point, you're accusing someone your daughter loved, someone who is the father of your grandchildren, someone you even liked, of something unthinkable. But Sandra trusted what she saw, and she was right. The sad part is that we also see the opposite pattern. Family members who have that same gut feeling but talk themselves out of it because the truth is too painful to accept. Sandra didn't do that. She acted, and I think that helped push the investigation into the right direction at a critical moment. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode. Make sure to rate, review, and follow America's Most Infamous Crime so we can keep building this community together. And to get all episodes at once, ad-free, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. Come back tomorrow for our final episode on the Watts family murders.